So as Jesse said, I write a column about innovation in the Boston Globe every Sunday called Innovation Economy, and also have a blog by that same name. And have been really interested in Kiva and some of the other internet lending projects as they've grown. So it's really fun to be able to have a conversation with Jessica this evening. And I think she's done a lot of speaking over the last couple days. I feel like you're nearing that threshold where you've done so many events in New Hampshire that people start to wonder, like, do you have presidential aspirations? But we want to make a lot of time for your questions. So we're going to talk just a little bit about sort of Jessica's career and the origins of Kiva, and then make plenty of time for questions from you. And just, I had two lines of introduction, which are that you earned your MBA from Stanford Business School. Mm-hmm. You helped launch the Global Philanthropy Forum there. Mm-hmm. You worked at Amazon.com, Potentia Media, the International Foundation, and World Vision. I guess where I'd like to start is if you would talk a little bit about just kind of your connection with Africa, I guess, which started while you were in college and you did semester at sea, and then you came back through to Kenya and Tanzania and Uganda for some projects. So just tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about kind of that initial connection with Africa. Sure. And kind of what you saw.
Sure. Microphones always make me feel a little bit funny, like I'm a rock star or something. I'm going to try to maintain composure. My actual relationship, I guess, with these ideas and these issues started really early on, and some have heard me speak before over the last 48 hours, but I have to say, like, two or three little bullet points before the
time. Let's just see. Has anyone been to some of the other Jessica Jackley Flannery World Tour events this week?
Okay,
no, so only
kidding.
Three or...
All right, awesome.
Only three or four, so...
I won't be offended if you kind of, like, are doing email or something like that.
Yeah. So you don't have to worry about repeating.
Okay, great. Well, I'll say this. So I have vivid memories of being a little kid and learning about poverty. It was actually the first time I remember about it. I was in Sunday school, and I remember learning two things. The first thing terrified me, and it was this idea that the poor would always be with us. And I imagined, like, my little brother wanting something from me and, like, nagging me and following me around the house. And that's what I thought it was to be poor. I thought it was somebody that wanted and needed something. And it's interesting because from a very early age, I think I was told I was in that category of people, this dichotomy in the world of people who could give, donors, you know, wealthy, powerful. And so I assumed they would be needing something from me and never leaving me alone, and it scared the pants off me. And I was like a little kid. I also learned in the same Sunday school class that, you know, the Bible said that Jesus said, what you would do for the least of these, you do to me. And that was a really empowering idea, that I was this kid that could help God. Like, I didn't even know God needed any help. And so this idea that I could do something of ultimate significance was a really powerful concept as well for me. Anyway, that was like one little glimpse into me, my psyche, I guess. And then fast forward a bit, I went on some service trips. I went to Haiti in my senior year of high school. I met people that were poor and had some of those negative kind of scared feelings come up again, but mostly just felt like confused. And like I didn't know what to do with this realization and the reality that many people in the world had lived a very different life than I got to be living. And to compound it, I come home, and it's, you know, 3 weeks later, it's senior prom. So I was freaking out. Like, I don't know if you would have wanted to be my friend as a senior in high school, because I was just kind of, I didn't know what to do with myself. I didn't know how to reconcile this experience that I'd had in Haiti with, you know, buying a fluffy, very fluffy dress and going to senior prom. So there's me in high school freaking out. Fast forward one more time. And in college, I went on a study abroad program called Semester at Sea. And in as much as Haiti freaked me out and kind of showed me that there was a much longer spectrum than I ever had imagined in terms of ways people could live in the world and opportunities that were out there and not out there for people. And in as much as I realized then I was on the lucky and blessed side of the spectrum, Semester C did that, you know, country after country after country, sort of rapid fire over a 3-month period. So it just blew my mind and kind of galvanized for me that there was something, you know, I needed and wanted to play some sort of role bridging that. You know, bridging this gap that I felt all the time between myself and the poor and people that had so much less than me. And again, it was mostly like an uncomfortable interaction. I didn't know what to do with it. I felt like every time I interacted with or encountered poverty, really, if I let myself really be affected and feel that, it was just awkward and weird, and I felt guilty and sad. And there's this focus on suffering and, you know, pity. So much so that, you know, often the way that I think we're taught to sort of soothe that pain is to whip out our wallets and give some money, and then we can feel better and get back to our lives. But I didn't think that was right either. So I didn't know what to do. So anyway, a few years after that, I heard about microfinance, and we can talk about this more if you want, but basically decided, okay, I think this could be my thing. I think I want to go figure it out. So then I moved to East Africa and interviewed entrepreneurs, all of whom had received just $100 to start a small business.
And when you first heard about microfinance, yeah. What did you hear about? Grameen
sure.
Bank and Grameen Phone, or was it something else?
I was working at Stanford at the time at the business school, and I stayed late after work, and there was this guy coming to campus who was lecturing on something called microfinance. His name was Dr. Muhammad Yunus, and it was 3 years before he would win the Nobel Peace Prize for his work kind of pioneering modern microfinance. But stayed after work, heard this guy talk, and two things really resonated with me. Number one, he talked about the poor in a way that for once in my life I wasn't feeling like panicky and freaking out and bad, because he talked about them as human beings that were strong, hardworking, very intelligent, although sometimes uneducated, entrepreneurs. And in Silicon Valley, there's kind of nothing cooler to be than an entrepreneur. So here are these amazing people that were sort of being re-presented to me in a new spirit, in a new light. And it was very moving to me because I realized I wasn't sitting there freaking out. So that was number one. Number two, he talks about how he started his own work. And it's basically, you know, there's this moment where he goes into a village himself, sits down with some basket weavers, and asks them directly why they're poor. And then is a really good listener and hears that they are poor because they're stuck in a cycle of lending with very high interest rates. And again, happy to go into more of that. But basically, it's sort of the rest is history. It's almost a fairy tale type story where he reaches into his pocket and he lends this whole village of women something like $24 or $27 and pretty much instantaneously gives them this opportunity that unlocks things for them. And they slowly are able to do what they do every day anyway, borrow money to buy basket weaving materials, weave these beautiful baskets, sell them and make a profit. And then they actually don't have to pay these crazy interest rates back. So they're able to keep some profit and lift themselves out of poverty slowly. So this is what I heard. The poor are not scary. And, you know, he started just by being a really good listener. And very naively, I thought, oh, I could be a good listener. I'd studied like philosophy and poetry in college, nothing business, nothing where when I was, you know, asked, what are my skills? Like, what was my... I had no idea what my skills were. I knew I could talk to people and be a good listener. So I quit my job at Stanford and moved to Africa. And that was when I really started to have an opportunity to hear stories.
You moved to Africa for good or just for some...
It was like for a 3 month period. But I had also just... I shouldn't joke about it, but I had also just started a lot of other new things in my life. I had only been married for 6 months and I like take off for three. And that was... And that's not prescriptive. I'm just telling you what happened in my life. But it was great because... I got to finally like do my dream, and that 3 months was a time for me when I feel like I just became so fully alive, because I was able to, that question that I'd been dealing with and the thing that made me kind of freak out and I could never settle in my mind and my heart, I was able to finally really address, because I was out there meeting entrepreneurs and getting to be friends with them and kind of overcoming this these barriers that I'd been told existed.
And when you say entrepreneurs, like give us a sense of the range
yeah.
of the people you were talking to.
Totally. Well, I mean, people like you would see on Kiva, but I met goat herders and seamstresses and people, I mean, people raising all different kinds of animals and all different kinds of plants, more or less, I mean, agriculture. People that had small restaurants. A lot of individuals who would buy and resell things. Maybe they would be the person in the village, you know, the only one to leave and go to town, or go more likely to like a trading center close by and buy, you know, soap or cooking oil or something like that, some household good, and then bring that back to town and resell that at a little bit of a profit and serve their community by the fact that no one else had to go out and make that trip. So things like this, really tiny, tiny little enterprises, and often they were the trade or just the activity that person had been doing for their whole lives anyway. But when they got this little infusion of capital, they were able to do a little bit more of it, and they were able to start to like have the trajectory change.
And just so, you know, for those of us who aren't familiar with kind of that sort of economy, where does credit come from before something like Kiva or before microlending? I mean, does credit come
sure.
from just someone in the village that, you know, is the money lender and
sometimes
is charging, you know, 20% interest or whatever?
Sometimes that's the case. Oftentimes, I mean, it so depends on different communities. If it's a very rural area, sometimes people don't even know this is an option. And just I'll tell you what, I've seen microfinance institutions, by the way, just to define terms in case this is a new concept for people, microfinance, you can think of that as like financial services and products for the poor. Microcredit, sometimes they're used interchangeably, but they shouldn't be, because microcredit is just one product. It's these small loans for the poor. On average, it's, you know, just a few hundred dollars. yeah, there's a lot to talk about here, so I'm trying to focus and only say the bullet points. But anyway, microfinance sort of, which created, and I told you the brief story of Muhammad Yunus's beginnings, but basically, it's these financial services and products are there for people that are otherwise unbanked, otherwise shut out of traditional financial systems.
They're not getting like a credit card offer every week in the mail.
No, unfortunately, no. They're not. Well, fortunately, no.
Right.
So, you know, often there's a correlation between being shut out of the traditional financial system and being a woman, and, you know, the ability to own land, and that's been challenged. So there are all these reasons why it's actually traditionally been focused on the needs of women. So you'll see a high rate of women borrowers and women clients and all of these things. But anyway, yeah, this often, like, it's very, very not uncommon for a village to just sort of exist, and people are living in that village, and there's no knowledge or understanding that there could be another way to live life, and like that things could really improve. And one day, this honestly happens some places, one day like a loan officer shows up and says, hey, I'm going to offer some training sessions over the next few weeks. I'll be back every Saturday at this time. Like, I'll tell you about business, tell you how to like form a group and talk to you about the idea, this thing that we have to offer you, which is, you know, a small loan or something. So, and they start from there. And then people are able to actually, for the first time ever, have even the idea that they might want to access this opportunity. And then that loan officer usually becomes a really important member of that community and comes back every week or every few weeks and provides the service.
Can you talk about just the origins of Kiva? Because I almost think about it a little bit as, you know, microfinance 1.0 versus microfinance 2.0, in that the first wave, it really was banks and maybe nonprofit institutions doing the lending, mm-hmm. and you guys had the insight of everyone in this room might actually want to become a lender,
yeah.
and that maybe, I don't know if it was a thought about tapping into pools of capital that were going to be more reliable on a year-to-year basis or what?
No, not at the beginning. And it's really funny, if we go back to that moment, you know, 5 years ago when I quit my job, I go to East Africa, this was my real experience. This was not a rocket science sort of, you know, complicated business plan in the beginning. It was me getting to interact with 150 entrepreneurs that had received this small funding and being just blown away by their stories. And the nature of the stories is such that they were cliffhangers, because you'd hear about this fisherman that had received a small loan, had started to change things for the better for his family, and things had just recently, you know, started to look up and up and up. And there wasn't an end to the story because that was the present time, and you thought, oh my gosh, well, what's next for you? And in the very remote areas where I was, there wasn't a microfinance institution around. But they knew that what they needed next was a small loan, and so we kind of looked around, and for a while I actually tried to talk to some other microfinance institutions to go to those areas. Some of them weren't interested. It was sort of a convergence of a lot of strange things that led to me and my partner Matt thinking about, okay, well, why don't we provide the funding for these people? And also, by the way, it'd be really fun because, you know, these are becoming our friends. We wanted to stay in touch. And it was kind of amazing to see that even 5 years ago, Uganda had, I don't know, like 80-something percentage cell coverage. So I'd be hours away from an electricity source in the middle of the mud hut, and I'd be able to call home. It was amazing. So we thought, how cool would it be if we left a cell phone with our new friend, the goat herder, and like, he could tell us how it goes over the next year if we lent some money? That would be so fun. So that, honestly, we were not like, oh, commercial capital, we have to tap into this new source of funding. It was not that at the beginning. It was, these are awesome people. I want to keep in touch when I go home. Wouldn't that be cool? That was really the like beginning kind of desire.
And I don't know if this is an apocryphal story or not, but what I read was that the first kind of round of Kiva loans,
yeah.
was like 7 businesses, $3,100,
yes.
and you said you spammed your wedding invitation list
totally
to get
did,
that money.
We didn't know for sure if it was legal, and we figured that our friends and family, especially those that like really loved us, and
they wouldn't
walked
sue you.
Like, they would, no, I'm not kidding. This was like, this is a great first like group to go to test this out with. So we wrote to them and we said, what do you guys say? We're not sure if it's legal. We're not sure if you're getting your money back, but we think you will. So do you want to do this beautiful social experiment with us? So 3,000 came in like basically overnight. We sent it over to our friend Moses. We were not official. We had no organizations working with us in the beginning. It was just kind of checks and cash and stuff to our bank account. We wired it over to Moses. Anyway, and then over...
And Moses was coordinating the loans to the individual businesses.
Yeah, because, again, no institution would work with us. We're like, won't this be fun? And we're like, what? What are you talking about fun? Fun is apparently not a value, like a competitive advantage. So for a lot of companies, are like an incentive, you know? It is to me, but it wasn't to them. So we got better with our language around that. Now, what they really respond to is source of seemingly limitless 0% debt capital. Like, that works, but fun didn't work so much at the beginning.
And that was 2005, that first round of loans.
Yeah, so March to October 2005, $3,100, seven entrepreneurs. We decided after they had repaid over those 6 months, and we got a lot of fun updates, like here's a picture of the new goat, so-and-so's doing really well, it rained at the market today, it was really muddy, you know, whatever. After that 6 months, we said, this has worked, our idea has worked, we will take the word beta off of our website and we will be real. And so thus launched Kiva in October 2005, and our first year was, we got a lot more legit, and we did 500,000 in loans that first year. We did 15 million the second year, third year was around 45, and we're only 3.5 years in, and now we do more than $1 million a week in these little $25 and $50 bits from friends and family and their friends and family and so on and so on, and from lenders in 185 countries around the world.
And at what point, I guess I'm just curious about the personal element of this, so you were kind of started working on the idea and kind of laying the groundwork for it. Your partner Matt was working at TiVo at the time.
He was.
So at some point you persuaded him, hey, this is an idea, it's worth leaving your job at TiVo.
Well, it was like quit TiVo or like leave Stanford Business School, which took me more than one application to get in, I'll tell you. So I didn't want to quit that. And he didn't really like his job that much at TiVo. We actually haven't, I haven't had a television for like 6 years. And so we had this TiVo not even plugged in the corner of the room. So anyway.
But like the company had given him for free or something?
Yeah, or something. Like we're supposed to be early adopters, but we weren't. So basically he quit his job and became CEO of Kiva, and he's still doing that today and he's doing a great job. But we also started to slowly build our team of volunteers and staff that were willing to work for, you know, very, very little, or free pizza, or sleeping on a couch, or whatever we could give them. We actually, our logo was designed by a friend who we couldn't pay, but we said, is there anything in our apartment that you want? And he really liked this old guitar we had, so we gave him the old guitar. And that's the logo that we use today.
And explain to us just sort of how it works today. So the loans are 0% interest, right?
Well, okay, it's a little bit
more. Like what
they
covers
are for lenders. So I'll walk you through, ready? So lenders come to the site, they browse entrepreneurs like this gentleman, Mokhtar Mbaye, I guess you'd say, in Senegal. So he's just one of many that you could see, but basically you can lend, you know, he needs all of his loan funding, he's brand new, and he's $425. Although I'll bet you if we refresh the page, like I wonder how much has been funded already. Don't do it, but I think it'd be interesting. Okay, do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If it's easy, is it easy to do?
Oh yeah.
I'm sorry, please, I didn't say please.
Please.
Well, anyway, lenders come to the site. Oh, you know, we might not be able to find them. Lenders come to the site, they browse profiles of entrepreneurs, and they choose, oh, darn it. All right.
We got a different entrepreneur.
Yeah. Oh, well. And they choose one or more entrepreneurs to lend to. And, you can click on this really easily and quickly and lend your $25, but let's just make it easy with the math. So let's say you come to the site, you want to lend $100 to this business, and that $100 goes straight from you to Kiva. We don't touch it, and in fact, PayPal, we're the first nonprofit to get PayPal to waive transaction fees, which has been incredibly helpful, sending $70 million plus back and forth. So that's been really nice. Thank you, PayPal. So the $100 comes through Kiva. We don't touch it. It goes straight through to the microfinance institution, which is kind of the equivalent of Moses in the beginning, but the institution that we work with over 100 of them in 50 countries. And that institution will administer the loan, you know, ASAP to that person. And then over time, that microfinance institution and their team will collect repayments, write updates, all that sort of thing, and then pass back the principal only from that institution through Kiva back to lenders. Now, entrepreneurs do repay their loans with interest that's fair and appropriate in that environment, and that is usually the exact same interest rate, I think always the same interest rate that microfinance institution was charging before, charges other clients that might not be posted on Kiva, etc. Those interest rates are on average 30 to 35%, which sounds like terrible, but it's very expensive work to do, and it actually, I mean, most of the organizations we work with, almost all of them are NGOs that are barely making ends meet, and it's heavily subsidized work anyway. But imagine that loan officer getting out into the village, for example, that I described earlier, once a week or so, once every other week for a year plus, just to do training and collect repayments and stuff. It's really expensive. Additionally, not all of an organization, like a microfinance institution's capital, is going to come from donations or from this beautiful, lender-generated 0% debt source on Kiva. A lot of it can come from loans and investments from other providers, like multilaterals or World Bank, things like that. And on average, they're going to pay at least 10-15% for their cost of capital. If you go to a local bank in, you know, the middle of Kenya or the Congo or something like that, you could imagine in economies like that, you're going to pay even a lot more, and that has to be passed on to lenders to cover costs, or sorry, to entrepreneurs to cover costs. So that's why interest rates are high.
And where does Kiva get its operating costs? Because you didn't say that any of the interest gets passed along to Kiva.
Yes, so I'm really proud of this. So we are a 501c3, but we like to say it's a tax code, not a religion, that you can still kind of operate like whatever you want to operate like and be smart about it. So we operate like a business in a lot of ways where it makes sense. So we've been actually cash flow positive in the past. We've been a more profitable nonprofit than we would be as a for-profit, which is crazy. It's true. So basically, most of our operational costs are covered by this optional lender fee. So right when you check out, we say, thanks for your loan. It's all going to the entrepreneur. It's all coming back. But would you help us pay our rent? You know? And most people, we suggest 10 or 15% on top of the loan. And most people say, okay, we're doing $1 million a week or more. You can imagine easily like $100,000 coming in a week just because we asked. So that covers a bunch of our costs. Number two, float. So as the money comes to Kiva before it goes out in the field, even if it's sitting in our accounts for a few hours or days, and as it's on the way back, and usually on the way back, it sits in the accounts for at least weeks, maybe not months, maybe months if lenders don't come back and like re-lend right away. So at any given time, that's millions of dollars, and we can invest that and make interest on that. That's number two. Number three, and there are five. Number three is unused credit. So let's say it's your birthday and I say happy birthday, here's $50, go lend on Kiva, you totally blow me off. Then eventually we reabsorb that money like after a year. Same with unused credit. If you're a deadbeat lender and you never come back, like over time something has to happen to that money. So even if it's after a few years, we can reabsorb that. It's a tiny one, but it's interesting, like breakage on gift certificates and stuff as a revenue stream. Four is corporate sponsorships and special programs. Like, we had a small business credit card company come to us and say, we'd really like to do a program with you where our clients don't just get airline miles or something, but they get Kiva credit when they use their cards. What do you say? And we said, great. And they said, great, well, we want to pay you to make this happen. And so we actually got revenue for designing something with them. Five, last but not least, is normal nonprofit fundraising like you'd expect. We do write grant proposals and have a handful of high net worth individuals that have helped us kind of get through lean times. What's interesting is we have other revenue streams kind of in the back that we haven't turned on, but we could. So for example, when an MFI, microfinance institution, is saving 10-15 plus on cost of capital with us, 10-15% or more on the cost of their debt capital, you know, we could charge them a bit of a percentage there, but our main problem, we don't plan to, because our main problem has been scaling to meet lender demand. We've run out of businesses frequently on the site, because we've had so much traffic and so much demand from lenders to put their money into Kiva that we run out.
Yeah, so I mean, let's emphasize
so
that.
We want to
it hasn't
really
happened.
Simple and keep it really attractive for microfinance institutions at 0%.
So just to kind of emphasize that point, I thought it was just once, but it's been a repeated problem that you just have too many people wanting to lend money and too few entrepreneurs who've kind of been approved as borrowers.
This is true. And if you think of entrepreneurs on the site, it sounds so like heartless, but as inventory, right? So you can increase inventory in two ways. One is by, this is why I went to business school, one is by increasing the number of partners that you have, obviously, but two is just having each partner post more. And the latter, both are very dangerous to do too quickly. So it takes time to do due diligence and find good partners and sign them on and slowly grow those relationships. And it also, you know, you don't want to push a microfinance institution to post more borrowers than maybe they would naturally be vetting and getting to.
And so the way that Kiva responded to that was, I think I recall, by limiting the amount that lenders could lend, right?
Yeah.
What was the limit?
Questions. Because, well, okay, I'm going to just say another thing. Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. So our mission, but it's relevant. Our mission is to connect people to lending to provide litigation. It is not, let's raise a lot of money because money's great. It's not, let's build a big network, a powerful network of microfinance institutions. It's about connecting people. So, given, you know, all else being equal, if the money's going to come anyway, we'd rather have more people involved than just the same amount of money but fewer people involved. So we don't do this anymore. There's, you know, I don't know if this is the best decision, but it's interesting, a little case study. We capped it. See that drop-down box where you could do 25 or, you know, all the way up to the 1,025 that entrepreneur needs. We did a quick fix on the website several times over the last few years where we would limit it at 25. You could, if you were a really smart lender, you could go back to and figure it out. But basically, we would rather have had, we wanted to have more lenders doing just 25 and come back later versus putting in 50 or 100 and taking that opportunity away from wow. other lenders. And we've turned down a bunch of money over the years when companies want to like put a bunch of money into Kiva without like people, like human beings behind the money to have this experience of lending and connecting with another person. So if we would have taken these like millions of dollars that we were offered for that, it would have actually gone against our mission because it would have taken opportunities away from other people to connect.
I'd love to have a couple last questions I want to ask, but I'd love to open up to you in just a minute. Tell me about, so at one point you took a leave from Kiva, you went and finished your MBA.
Well, no, Kiva started right like in the second, so March through October of 2005 was our beta. October 5 we launched for real. I had just started my MBA program. It was insane because I studied poetry, remember? So this was really hard. Business school was really hard for me. So it started during business school.
Okay, so you were doing the two things in parallel.
Like it started right before, and then we thought it'd be our nice side project on nights and weekends, and then it like took off.
And did you decide at some point in the last year or so, I mean, I know now you're sort of, did you decide at some point to sort of step away from the operations and kind of?
Yeah, so I graduated about 2 years ago now, and the first year I was back in the office doing day-to-day stuff. I was focusing a lot on marketing, on hiring. We had so many people to hire in the last year. That was a big job, and then also on some of the microfinance partnerships that I like going out in the field, and I can be somewhat useful in East and West Africa with language skills and stuff. So I did a little bit of that. But then in June, for a lot of different reasons, you know, suddenly it's a weird thing to be an entrepreneur and person after person, you hire person after person that's better than you are at like their job, and you hand off different pieces. And so I felt like it was a great time for me to be able to step away, kind of catch my breath. And then also I get to do things like this. And I'm thinking about doing another adventure in the next few months.
All right. And I guess the last question I want to ask is, you know, if you talk about the microfinance world today, kind of what are the issues, you know, for those of us who aren't inside it, like what are the issues that the microfinance world deals with? And maybe, you know, what are some of the issues that Kiva has stirred up with kind of this new approach to things?
So I think it's funny, like, this is all, I kind of told you my career, it's not very extensive, it's this one thing, and I've never even worked in a microfinance institution per se, so it's funny, sometimes people ask me, like, how do I do a career in microfinance? I'm like, I don't know, I do this one thing, and I know how to get a job there, but that's it. So anyway, from my limited perspective, I think what's happening in microfinance is that there are, so you have, we'll just paint the picture, you have 10,000 some microfinance institutions out there. The vast majority of investment capital, so like commercial capital, you know, the city groups of the world, they're putting their funding in the top 100 or 200 of these like 10,000 some NFIs. So there's a very long tail of smaller, up and coming kind of rising stars. Maybe they're the Grameen banks of 20 years ago. And Kiva has been able to really bring attention to them and provide incentives for them to like get rated, get on a rating system, you know, get audited financials, get more official, get online, get technology. So we provided, I think, an incentive for those smaller, slower growing institutions to sort of, you know, step it up a little bit in different areas. That's cool. But I guess the truth is there are a lot of, I like to think in terms of like a spectrum. And there are lots of spectra that you can think of. There's the one I just kind of showed you, the larger and more established MFIs, and the smaller ones and the younger ones. There are sort of MFIs that think more about, you know, being sustainable right now and making a profit right now and not having to subsidize anything and moving from NGO status to a non-bank financial institution status to a, you know, for-profit, like Compartamos-esque sort of for-profit real bank. There are others that have a social mission and say we should serve everyone that we can no matter what the cost, because this is like basically a human right to have access to this, you know, economic opportunity. So you have all kinds of MFIs. You're doing all sorts of things. We believe that there are a lot of smaller ones, you know, socially focused ones that are worth highlighting and giving a platform to showcase their work. So I think it's brought a lot of those more to the forefront of the conversation. I also think it's been interesting to see how, you know, a lot of, gosh, how do I say this tactfully? Let me think for a second. I guess our team is very young, and we've, especially over the last year, hired a lot more people with really solid experience. But in the beginning, I mean, I told you exactly how it started. It was just sort of this fun idea. And to come into an industry that is made up of a lot of really experienced people, many of whom left, you know, careers in finance and then moved to microfinance, like they know their stuff. And it was a very interesting industry to sort of disrupt with this. And so there have been criticisms about, you know, this source of capital isn't stable, and isn't consistent and it's like messing up the market because we're providing this really beautiful low-cost debt, I mean free debt, and that's messing things up because then other investment funds, when they're offering 5%, which used to be super low, it's, you know, it's not as competitive. So this is a hard question because there's about a million things to talk about. Do you want me to stop?
Well, I guess I'm curious. You got me thinking about other things, which is, this is a very simple yes or no question. I mean, has Kiva seen a decrease when people say, oh, it's not a reliable source of funding? I mean, has Kiva seen a decrease with the economic downturn of people lending?
No, actually, we haven't.
No kidding.
And again, like, our problem has been just let's scale responsibly. It's this huge pipeline of interest and funding with this incredibly enthusiastic lender community that does so many amazing different things on their own, which is another conversation. But no, we set our projections, you know, before the economy took the turn, and we are still actually exceeding those projections right now. The mix of funding coming in, a lot of it's re-loans, you know, someone who's already loaned their money, it's come back, and now they're just re-lending it out. There's a higher percentage of that, higher ratio of that to new funding, but even still, both of those are still going up and up and up, and we're having higher take rate, higher transaction rate, all the little metrics that we have on our Google Analytics dashboard, et cetera, et cetera. We're doing great, and last year we had our biggest month ever, and it was $4.5 million. So we're doing great, actually. And I'm not sure exactly why, but I have all these, like, ideas about why. I think lenders...
I mean, because every other, you know, nonprofit institution seems to be really, you know, crying out now, saying our donations have really just plummeted, corporate
enough,
and individual.
We're doing okay, and I think it's because this is not a donation, it's a loan, and it lives in this different category in people's minds. Like, it's something you do to be engaged and feel good and help somebody, but also, you know, it's sustainable, and you kind of, I think people just keep their money in the system and keep relending, and there always is a little reason to maybe just add one more because it's fun. And I should stop saying fun. I've said that enough. I think it's really fun. But it's not a donation. It's not this investment. It's interest bearing. So it lives in a different category in people's minds, apparently. And so they've kept at it.
Interesting. So some questions from you, if there are some. I could ask questions all day, so I could keep going.
As I understand it, you're actually one step removed from Mr. Davo there.
We are.
And what is your quality control? What is your evaluation system? How you go back and see how's Mr. Davo doing a year from now? Because you're not doing anybody a favor if you're lending to them.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Do
like, does this guy have a credit rating in the construction?
Although, in all seriousness, what we have seen is sometimes after someone's received a loan, again, Mr. Gabo may very well be illiterate and have no other like form of identification, but now he has a picture and his name and story that is posted on a website, and he can go to that site after he's repaid his loan, print out his entrepreneur profile, and take it to a bank and say, check me out, this is me, photo ID, this is my credit, this is what I've done recently with credit, give me a bigger loan. It's awesome. So there, anecdotally, there's really interesting stuff that you can do with that, speaking of credit score. So we spend a lot of time doing due diligence on our partners before we even start, which is why, even though, you know, we have all this demand, it's slow going to do these partnerships well. So we do all sorts of stuff. We have financial data that they report. We get audited financial data. We send Ernst & Young out.
But for this guy individually, I mean,
your
partner just kind of probably interviewed this guy, right?
They have their own due diligence process that makes sense in each community where we work, which is, you know, over 100. So, and in fact, over 100 organizations that work in a variety of other communities. So they have their own processes. So there's all, actually, we have a great area on the site that outlines each level of risk. It's like lender risk, entrepreneur risk, microfinance partner risk, Kiva risk. What if Kiva goes under, right? We don't plan on doing that. But anyway, so there's a lot to talk about all those different layers, and I can give a short answer and say that we have really rigorous due diligence before we partner with an institution. We have probably 50-some microfinance institutions in the queue, and again, we're already partnering with just like 100, so that's a lot that are going to come live on the site in the coming months. So before, during, and after, as we have the relationship ongoing, we do these hard audits with Ernst & Young and stuff and our own staff visiting. We also do soft audits where we have volunteers visit all the time. We have more than 200 people we've sent out in our fellows program, which is a minimum 10-week commitment, and it's sort of my dream job from 5 years ago where you interview 150 entrepreneurs, I'm familiar, and blog about them on the site. And when they're there, they get to really see the quality of service being delivered to those entrepreneurs, so they do visit the actual entrepreneur. And they spend a lot of time, like at least a few months, with that core team, that management team, and the microfinance institution. So we get a lot of valuable data that way too. And when we do find cases of, you know, oops, this name was spelled wrong, or oh, it says 850, but they really received an $800 loan, or things like that, we encourage and like beg our fellows to tell us about this and report it on the site, which they do. Mm-hmm. So we don't hide the mistakes. We like very clearly state if that happens, and it's rare, but we just correct it and keep moving forward.
So some other questions. There was one over there. How about on the aisle? Yeah, first. You first.
Just a question about, I've been talking with some MFIs in relation to the Kiva model. One of the things they mentioned is would be beneficial for them is sometimes is essentially line of credit mm-hmm. as opposed to funding individual loans. Mm-hmm. Do you guys see moving in that direction so that, you know, rather than like loaning to individuals, people could be contributing to a larger pool that then establishes a line of credit, that especially for that mid-size MFI as opposed to the long tail MFI?
Yeah. So I would say everyone else does that. So I can tell you like 80 different microfinance investment funds that do that. And I actually don't think the problem is like lack of capital. I know for the mid-size it's a little more difficult.
Yeah, that's the ones I'm thinking about. There's
yeah, so it'd be great for someone to step up and like design that solution, like go for it, do it. But we need to focus on what we're doing. And I know that it doesn't solve every problem and lines of credit would be great. We're trying to, you know, slowly I actually think we could work instead of doing what everyone else does, like these aggregated, you know, mitigated risk kind of funds, and we're doing something on the extreme other end of the spectrum, and I think we'll maybe get there coming from this and slowly over time where you'll see larger loan sizes on the site. There'll be more ways to engage and to lend, and maybe eventually we'll get there, but I think this is what makes us special is the fact that it's direct and individual, and like if the entrepreneur defaults, you don't get your money back because it's a real person that you've put your money towards. So I like that, and I think moving away from that would actually just really hurt us and hurt what we're trying to do.
And what's the default rate? Just give us a sense.
It's 98.12 repayment rate.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, you.
What do more traditional forms of philanthropy have to learn from the Kiva experience?
I'm biased, but I guess I would say, you know, there's so much other need out there. We're doing one very specific thing, and I think, like, it happens to be a really good fundraising tool, but the best thing I think we can do, this is kind of my soapbox, the best thing I think Kiva does is provide a way for all of us to connect with each other on these relationships that are based on dignity and respect and not these sad, pitiful things, right? So it's money with thought and with intention behind it. It's not just a bunch of funds like out there floating around and you write your check and you go to do your other thing. Hopefully you're kind of engaged in thinking about this person. And I guess some of the best fundraising advice I've ever gotten is, you know, if you ask for money, you'll probably just get advice. And if you ask for advice and engage that person and really bring someone along in this movement and what you're doing, maybe eventually if they have the capacity, funding will come through. But it'll be because they're involved and they're already sold on what you're doing and they're already part of it. And so I guess like that is what I've seen. Like people, I don't think they're just doing this as an interesting little experiment with $25. Hopefully, I think they love it. I think we have really enthusiastic lenders because they're having an experience that has really touched them. That's my hope. So I guess like a lot of philanthropy, I think it's almost like do what you need to do to get the money. And there's strange ways out there that people get money or ask for money or I think strange little heartstrings that they pull on that kind of mess up to just get the money and then go do really good work. But there's all this disconnect. And it's you know, there's a lot of things that a lot of foundations and organizations shouldn't do because it's not their charge to do it. But like, I love the foundations that fund operational costs. Cause it's hard to do and it's not as like sexy and interesting. So it's great that those exist. I also think a lot more information could be revealed for your like average everyday donor or lender because I know that I've only ever been able with my nonprofit salaries to donate, you know, $25, $1,500 at a time, and usually the interaction that I get from nonprofits out there is a form letter that says, it's all generic, it's dear friend,
yeah,
thank you for your recent contribution, there's not even a number on it, and, you know, that's kind of the end of the relationship, and I think there could be a lot more done there. I hope it's not a paper letter, but just, like, there's so much data, there's so much information out there, it's so easy to capture these days, I'd love for more of that to be.
Well, it also seems like you've tapped into kind of people's desire to participate and to sort of feel like they're collaborators with you,
yes,
as opposed to just, here's my check,
yeah,
you know, you send me the next, you know, fundraising letter in another 2 months or whatever.
Yeah, and there's also, I have to say, I think it's like a low pressure situation where like, we think this is awesome, if you guys want to do it, great, and if not, like, please don't come. And, like, you can opt out of giving that extra donation at checkout, because if you're going to grumble about it, like, don't worry about it. Just lend and have your experience. It's fine. Like, it's fine. Other people will subsidize you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think a lot of my relationships with other nonprofits, it's always this, like, predatory thing where it's like, you gave $50 last year, give $75 this year, give $100 this year, and you're like, nah, I know you're out there. I already like you. I'm going to, but don't do that. So I feel like we have this style that hopefully is, like, friendly and, like, no pressure, and
mm-hmm.
come along for the ride if you want to, and if you don't, do something else that you love, and that's great.
So another question here.
Yeah,
lots of questions.
I had a question. I'm hesitant to call it work marketing, but
that's okay.
How do you, I mean, it seems to be, so how is the word getting out about Kiva? How have you primarily marketed Kiva so that more and more people know about it?
So the main thing in the beginning, in our very first month, that, like, second month I was in business school in November of 2005, our little side project, 7 businesses, we just posted like 12 more, so we had under 20 businesses on the site ever, and the blogosphere started to pick up on what we were doing. Excuse me. And suddenly, in November of 2005, 300 blogs wrote about Kiva, including 2 of the most widely read in the world at the time. So suddenly, not just friends and family knew about our little side project on nights and weekends, but 1 million people read about Kiva one day on the Daily Coast. It was Daily Coast and Boing Boing, one of the 2 big ones. I never read a blog at that point, so, like, this was all news to me. And that happened, so the blogosphere picked up on things. From that, a lot of natural other uptake happened with, you know, other media. I wish I could say, here's how to get on this, you know, new show or Oprah or whatever. I don't know exactly how that happened, but sort of the blogosphere kicked it off. And that was one way that we've grown. It's actually not the best way to grow in a web-based business, because you have these crazy spikes in traffic, your servers break, and, like, it's not break, but, you know, I'm not the tech person in Kiva, actually. So anyway, they're over capacity, and you can't, it's hard to handle that kind of growth. Especially when you think about how slow it is and difficult it is. It's really hard to work in the field, do microfinance. You're pitching up like this, I don't know what it would be like, but like a guy, you know, walking along the street on foot with like rocket ship internet, super lightning speed. It's crazy to be in the middle of that.
And Kiva was on Oprah at some point?
We were on Oprah a year and a half ago.
And what did that do? I mean,
it shut us down for 5 days.
Did she give you a free car or something?
No. But
in terms
really
of just the servers melting down and not being able to handle
it. Oh, no. Well, then actually you can see the traffic like went up. It was a huge spike, and we did design a like lovely splash page that said, we're a young and growing nonprofit. Help us find new servers.
Uh-huh.
And so I think we raised like $100,000 in 2 days just from donations of people to like help us find new servers. And then the traffic was permanently up at a new level, which was really fun. Yeah, that was, oh gosh, I'm so tempted to tell funny stories, but I'm not going to. I'm going to focus, because you asked about
marketing. Was it a funny story about Oprah?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, no, I mean, maybe this isn't that funny, but like, okay, there are two. They're really quick. They're so funny.
Yeah.
Okay, number one, did you know that they airbrush your face? Like, I thought they airbrushed photos on Photoshop on the computer after, like, two-dimensional, digital,
yeah,
whatever. No, like, first of all, they're like 18 makeup people and stuff, and then they literally close your eyes and they like airbrush your face, like spray paint on your face, which I thought was amazing. Okay, that was one. I thought that was awesome. Number two was they have all these people come in and prep you for like the hours that you're sitting in the green room, and they're like, hello, Miss Winfrey will be, maybe this is top secret. Is this part being recorded? I don't think it's top secret though.
Okay.
I'm just going to say it.
Lots of us have been on Oprah. I mean,
yeah, I know,
half
so
the audience knows, so I'm sorry.
We all know what I'm going to say next. So basically, they have someone come in and they prep you and they say, so here's the way the show's going to unfold. We're going to generally talk about this in the first segment, you know, between commercials, which all this was new language to me since I don't have TV. So segments are between commercials, right? So you're going to be in the fourth segment, and Ms. Winfrey will probably ask you the following kinds of questions. And I was like, wow, I can't believe it's scripted. I'm thinking that in my head. And then they say, and based on our research of you, here are the responses we guess that you will give. And I'm like, don't tell me what to say. Like, freedom of speech. Like, I'm going to say whatever I want to say. But then they read the answers, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that would be like the perfect version of me. I want to say. They really did a good job researching, and they pulled like the perfect lines from every interview up until that point. And I was like, I want to say those things. Yes, tell me what to say. Anyway, she went off script, and it was like not a non-issue anyway. But I was like, wait, what do I say again? What do I say?
Did you recognize her when you came onto the stage, or because you don't have TV, you'd never?
Like, a decade ago, I didn't recognize her.
Okay.
But. Okay, marketing, I just need to say one more part of it. So basically, blogosphere, and then we believe, I mean, I was the only marketing person we've had thus far, really, and then doing this these days. So the main marketing things we've done are, you know, invest actually in the products and make it a better product so people love it and spread the word, and make it really easy for them to spread the word and be really open with our brand. So we build tools for people to share with friends and family. We have lending teams that engage people. We are really open with, seriously, we have so many things on our site that you can just go get and then do it yourself. So for example, lenders have like taken this and run with it, and they have created the most amazing things that we would have never had the bandwidth to do, just our staff. So we're very much believers in, you know, crowdsourcing and stuff. So lenders have created, just to rattle off like a few things, Kivapedia, not us, lenders, Kiva TV, where you can go and 24/7 watch every video that's ever been made on kivatv.org, I think. There's a Kiva store someone made where they like took the logo and put it in all this stuff and sell it, and then we get the profits from that. There's apparently Kiva has an office in Second Life, which is kind of awesome. None of us were actually on Second Life, but we got an invitation to an office forming party at a Kiva office in Second Life, which apparently is in a really good area or something, good real estate. So that's cool. So lenders kind of take this and run with it, and we just say, go for it, and thank you. And so I think people own this themselves, and what we hope for is that we'll have more and more and more of this grassroots sort of spreading of the word.
All right. So, boy, lots more questions. How about you?
Like, what's the process that, like, people need to go through to, like, take their entrepreneurship?
That's a great question. So, it's different community to community, but usually what happens is this. Usually step one will be, you know, some sort of introduction from the microfinance institution. Oh, wait, do you mean actual lenders? How do lenders pick their entrepreneurs? How's that guy get on the site? Okay, got it. I want to answer the right question here. So basically, we have all these, like, I'm calling them microfinance institutions, but they're these, like, banks for the poor all around the world. So imagine, you know, your local bank here and all the things you can get there. You can get savings, a savings account. You could do, you could get a small loan. You could do insurance products, things like that. So microfinance institutions are like these banks for the poor, and they take all those products and services and kind of tailor them to the needs of someone living on a few dollars a day, right? So that's these organizations. So what they do, they are experts in their community, and they basically go out into these areas and say, hey everyone, we have an offer for you. Or they're kind of like selling this interesting product to them. They'll say, we could offer you a loan, and step one is to like come to these training sessions. This is what I think is like the best way that it usually works. There should be some training first. That's often one of the most valuable things they can provide. So they'll talk to them about business and like what it means to take a loan and what it means to repay it and how you do that and how you manage things and what it means to keep a record of your accounts and really basic stuff. And then they'll come back, you know, and provide this funding to people once they kind of meet certain qualifications, which are, this is your question, usually they'll ask people to form groups with their friends, which actually is a really good way to make sure that, you know, if someone is known in their community, like you would know at your school which people you probably wouldn't be super excited about being like tied to financially and like taking a big loan together. You'd be like, I don't know if I want to, you were kind of like a loose cannon. Like, I don't know if I want to take a loan with you because you probably won't repay. So that actually is a good first step. It weeds out a lot of people. So if someone's in a group with five other people that'll vouch for them, that's a good sign. So that's number one. There are also these probably like the basic things that you could imagine. A lot of like basic information on who they are, what they want to do. Do they have any sort of idea of what their very modified business plan would be? Do they know, you know, what they want to sell? Do they grow, you know, maybe bananas and pineapples and cassava or something? What do they want to sell? What do they want to price it at? Where do they want to sell it? What are they going to use with the small loan? So like really basic questions about what are you planning to do? And sometimes at that point, if it's a really good microfinance institution, they'll say, okay, you're in a group, that's good, you have a good idea, but you still need to work on a few things before you're really ready for this loan. So sometimes that happens too. But it's so different all around the world. It's so many different communities, so many different ideas of what a good, you know, borrower will be, but that's like my very basic answer. Does that answer your question? Okay, off.
Okay, yes, third row.
I have a curiosity about whether you have any mechanism for determining what the loans are for.
Yeah. So, do I need to repeat the question, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay. So the question is sort of like, what controls or what do we do to encourage the development of businesses that are maybe more sustainable and more about maybe green businesses, but just sustainable businesses, healthy things, good for the community, et cetera, versus like selling a bunch of maybe crappy plastic toys or something, I don't know, but like Western stuff and perpetuating maybe certain parts of capitalism that are not healthy and not sustainable, right? Okay, so basically we just pick great institutions to work with and we trust them to do that because we can't micromanage what they do. We can provide them resources and tools when we can do that. But we're working with institutions that already have a very clear idea of how to work best in those communities and what are good businesses in those communities. They define them in different ways. It would be really nice to see, you know, more people doing a bicycle taxi versus, I don't know, like selling charcoal or something. But we don't want to impose our ideas on them. We want to let them do what they want to do to grow their economies and to fund their businesses. So what's interesting is, you know, lenders can make that choice. Lenders can choose not to fund someone on the site if they don't believe in the business. And sometimes you'll see different businesses. Well, it's definitely the case that certain businesses get funded a lot more quickly and more readily than other ones. So sort of the idea is to let the market of lenders do what it does and to just empower the microfinance institutions to know their communities well enough and to be smart enough to do what's best for them. So we don't impose much on them at all.
All right. So, yes?
Question for you. I've lived and spent a lot of time in Kenya, and in my experience, graft is part of the culture, as is sort of government involvement.
When you say graft, what do you mean? Sorry.
Paying off for the ability to have audience, or you know, basically it's exchange of money for facilitation of introductions, whatever it may.
So like bribery, so we're on the same page, and corruption,
yeah.
And things like that.
Yeah. Do you see that, and then how do you mitigate that?
Again, what Kiva does best are the following three things: building a great technology, a great platform, driving traffic to that website, and then choosing great partners that we really put a lot of trust in. So we're not necessarily out there on the ground like duking it out with the local politician that wants to offer a bribe for something. We trust the organizations to manage those situations as they come. We'll help them whenever they reach out if we can, and when we see problems or troubleshoot, we pause relationships. We'll totally stop relationships altogether if we see it. But again, we have to be focused on what we can do best. And like, I have tried, I went twice to Ghana last year to like fight crime. And I'm not good at fighting corruption in Ghana myself. Like you gotta pull in people that know the game and like know the local scene.
That's what I was gonna ask you.
Yeah,
so when you've been in Africa as an individual, I mean, you see some level of that, right? You know, anytime someone's trying to do business in some of these countries,
Yes, but I have to say, I just wanna like stick up for these, you know, the general African population, I guess. Like, there are good people doing good stuff, and it's not everywhere you look. It's definitely there, but there are people sticking up for the right thing, and the more and more we can empower great organizations that also stand for those principles, the better it is, and who am I to go into a culture and say you should do things this way anyway? I'm not going to do that. So, good question.
All right. Back there.
Do you know of anyone who's doing something similar at Central America?
Well, when you say something similar, I mean the theme, like we have partners in Central America, we have partners all around the world, there are microfinance institutions all around the world, there are other microfinance investment funds that you can invest in that have institutions in South America, there are giving sites that have projects in South America, so what do you mean exactly?
Well, does Kiva does have lenders in places, does have borrowers in places other than Africa, right?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I mean,
We've been very Africa-focused.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, and that's all you've seen on the site. Oh, sorry. No, we have, so on my, if I had my presentation, I would kind of rattle off. These are people that I've loaned to, a popcorn seller in Samoa, butcher in Afghanistan, group of vegetable sellers in Kenya, a taxi driver in Bulgaria, a carpet weaver in, I loaned to a hairdresser in Iraq, a bicycle repairman in Ecuador. Like, they're all over doing all kinds of things.
Yeah, they're already... He was already on it.
Sorry, I'm so sorry I misunderstood your question. It's been a long day.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about different measures of success that you have. You've had a series of metrics, which are certainly interesting. You mentioned this idea of fellows who actually blog from the field that provide you with a richer measure of success. Mm-hmm. But how do you measure how the quality of lives of your recipients are changing, and at the same time the connection of how your lenders' quality of lives are changing?
We're getting closer to being able to do this at all. So in the beginning, and it's still kind of the beginning actually, like things have been moving so quickly that it's all we can do to, you know, keep up with the demand from lenders. So what we didn't want to do, it was, you know, charge interest to our microfinance partners We wanted to make the transaction and the whole interaction as lightweight and as seamless and frictionless as possible. Sometimes they provide information on their own related to the changes in standard of living and quality of life of their entrepreneurs. But like when you work in so many different countries, it's really hard to have a standardized set of questions that you, first of all, just get that list of questions that means anything. Because maybe in Kenya, it's like really important to be able to put sugar in your tea and buy a mosquito net. Maybe in another country, it's really important to like be able to have a warm blanket at night. And maybe in another country, you know, the best number one thing you should be thinking about is like sending your daughters to school. And there's all sorts of ways to measure everywhere. So first of all, coming up with that list is hard. Number two, you know, we didn't want to require yet another thing for our partners to do at this stage in the game. We just wanted to like get things going. So it's absolutely on our radar screen, absolutely something that we want to be able to provide more information around and require of our partners as time goes on.
I guess I'd love to ask maybe, unless there is one last question from the audience that you've been dying to ask.
Back from
one
there.
More from you, yes. Yeah, do you get any post repayment updates?
Gosh, you guys, I've like missed some of the basics. I'm so sorry if I've missed. It's like that movie Groundhog Day. I'm like, did I say this already? Did I? So, yes. So over the course of the loan, you would get updates. So at very least, you know, you'd get thanks for your funding. You know, it's been distributed to this entrepreneur, and it's a message like from the field, from the loan officer that's administered that loan. So it's right from, you know, Senegal or wherever else you've loaned to. And then over the course of the loan, let's say it's a 9-month loan and repayments are being made every 2 weeks or something, you'll get an email every time that person repays. And let's say you've loaned $25, maybe you get back like $1.67, you know, $2.34. You get back those little bits every 2 weeks as they repay, and you can use those, you know, you have to add to them to have another $25, but you can use those as they come in. And ideally with our fellows and other updates just from that loan officer, What's awesome is when, and I think it's like 1 out of 4 at this point, at least has one of these kinds of updates. But basically, you can sometimes even get pictures and like much longer stories about what is going on with that entrepreneur's life. You can get little sentences pretty easily, but sometimes, like if we send a Kiva fellow out, it'll be someone that, you know, maybe is from the US that would think it's really interesting to write about what life is like in this village and what the mud hut looks like and what it's like inside. And they'll write about things that loan officer might not have thought were that interesting because they're kind of day-to-day stuff. Anyway, and then at the end of the loan, almost always there's a longer report on, you know, thank you so much, the loan's been fully repaid, and here are some things that have been improved in that person's life and things that are better thanks to your loan. So we're trying for, like, I would love it if every lender had many of those updates. It's just so much work that, and again, we've had to grow that we haven't always been able to acquire that of all the people out
and
there.
Is there a minimum age for participation to be one of these fellows traveling?
21.
Okay, so you're not quite there yet. we can't ship you to Ecuador,
thank you for your
I guess.
Question. Thanks for your really good questions.
Well, I want to thank everybody for their questions, and please help us thank Jessica for being here this evening.
Thank you.